Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 11th of September. And our guest this hour is Steven Pinker. Steven is the author of a number of books. He's with the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. And his latest book, The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature, has just been published in paperback. It has been described as a display of fiercely intricate intelligence, and nobody with the least interest in language should miss reading it. Pinker is a star, and the world of science is lucky to have him. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for Steven during the course of this hour. 800 is 486-8655. The book looks at language as a window into human nature. It's a close look at language in the mind, the meanings of words, what we can learn about our makeup from the way people put their thoughts and feelings in words. Our abstract concepts are understood in terms of concrete scenarios. We talk about what is an event. We talk about the 16 words in the State of the Union speech. And what does William Shakespeare mean? There's a good question. And other names. That and much more this hour with Professor Steven Pinker. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, it's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Steven Pinker, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello.
Hi. How did September 11 become known as 9/11? I found that objectionable early on, and it's been used so much now that I use it as well. But in the days after, 9/11 just seemed too little a use of words to describe the enormity of what happened.
That's true, but on the other hand, there's no guarantee that weighty events will have weighty names. The name for an object doesn't have to be like the object. And there's often a real premium put on brevity in language. Our most common words are our shortest words. And for anything that you have to refer to over and over again, the word will shrink over time. Television becomes TV. Personal computer becomes PC. Refrigerator becomes fridge. So replacing the three syllables of September with a single syllable of nine helped the expression stick. There may even have been a bit of a spillover with the idea that you dial 911 in case of an emergency. And the direness and near panic of the event, I think, made the 9/11 association help the term stick.
Oh, that's interesting. You talk about the events. The book starts with 9/11, actually, and whether or not this was an event or two events, and the significance of that. It's a very interesting story. I knew nothing about.
Yes, well, my challenge in writing a book on semantics is that most people think of semantics as pointless hair splitting or niggling over the meaning of words to in a way that would interest only librarians and editors and so on. So I wanted an example where semantics makes a difference, and a difference that you can put a dollar value on. And the debate over how many events took place on September 11th in 2001 in New York was a good example. So how many events took place that morning? Well, you could say that it's one event. We refer to it as 9/11. It was the Al-Qaeda conspiracy. Or you could say it's two events. There's World Trade Center 1, World Trade Center 2. Each was hit by a different airplane. Each went out of existence at different times. And that would seem like a perfect example of a debate like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
Mm-hmm.
But no, the leaseholder for the World Trade Center held an insurance policy that entitled him to $3.5 billion per event.
Oh my.
So if it was one event, he stood to gain $3.5 billion. If it was two events, he stood to gain $7 billion. So what is a semantic distinction worth? $3.5 billion.
Right.
And one of the reasons that there's still a hole in the ground in Lower Manhattan instead of a Freedom Tower is that it took the lawyers several years to come to an agreement on how many events took place that morning.
What is an event?
Well, an event is, a physicist can't tell you what an event is. Time is continuous. It's a seamless analog ribbon of matter and energy moving through space. It's the human mind that imposes events on the world, and it generally does so by looking for some change of state. In particular, a change of state that is the goal of a human action. Now, different verbs will do that in different ways, reflecting the fact that the mind can chop the happenings in the world into events in different ways, and that's what we're the aspect of the mind that we're seeing in the debate over how many events took place that morning. Namely, are you defining an event in physical terms, building collapses, or are you defining the event in terms of a human goal, namely terrorize the United States?
Mm-hmm. And some people have criticized you for saying that the gravity of 9/11 would seem to make this entire discussion frivolous. And yet, when you look at money involved and how some people interpret this, it's not really frivolous, is it?
Indeed. And people often ask, why has no replacement tower been built yet?
Right.
It took a fraction of that amount of time to build the entire Empire State Building. And here we are, literally exactly seven years later, and nothing has been done. And that's one of the reasons that nothing has been done. So it is consequential. It's not just an academic exercise.
Have the words that we use now describing that day that we all remember when we think about it, and we think about it now because it was happening right about this time, have they changed significantly? Do we have a different political perspective on it, emotional perspective on it?
I think we do. For example, you rarely see photographs of the disaster, which were constantly in the news in the days and weeks after the event. So you rarely see a photograph of the towers on fire or of the collapse or of the terrorized people on the ground or the people jumping from the tower. It's entered a zone of memory in which we don't want to see the graphic details. It's also, of course, been highly politicized,
right,
most infamously by Rudy Giuliani, who I forget who said that every sentence coming out of Giuliani's mouth consists of a sentence, a verb, and 9/11.
Right. And it was also used by the Republican National Convention with a very graphic photos of what happened on September 11 at their convention.
Oh, okay. Well, then I missed. I mean, in general, you don't see a lot of photographs, so I wasn't tuned in at that moment.
Yeah, and that's what made it perhaps even more shocking, because you're right, we haven't seen a lot of pictures, and there it was again.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me about your fascination with language. When did all of this start? Because you were so intricately involved with this. It just is amazing to me.
Yes, I've written one book on irregular verbs. I wrote another one on transitive and intransitive verbs, and there's a lot of verbs in this book. A colleague, one time when I was talking excitedly about this verb or that one, and she said to me, "They really are your little friends, aren't they?" I didn't start off as a language lover. I'm really a cognitive psychologist. I'm interested in how the mind works. Language is one of the most important topics in cognitive science. It's the one in which I've done the most of my research. But ultimately, I'm interested in language for what it says about the human mind, both what it says about our ability to use language itself, just to sequence words in grammatical constructions that make sense, that convey a message. And in this book, in the kinds of meanings that we express using language, the kinds of meanings that, the kinds of thoughts that we put into words, and the way in which we use language in a social setting to not just convey information, but also to cement or change our relationships.
Mm-hmm. You can tell my interest is in politics here, but we're in a heavy political season. You talk at one point about the State of the Union address delivered by the president and the 16 words that, from your perspective, all revolved around the verb learn. Can you talk about that? It's interesting.
Yeah, well, there's another case in which semantics makes a big difference. This was the 2003 State of the Union address in which George W. Bush said, this is prior to the invasion of Iraq. He said, British intelligence has learned that Saddam has tried to obtain significant quantities of uranium in Africa. Now, the word learn is what linguists call a factive verb. That is, it implies that what has been learned is correct. So I can't say that I learned that the moon is made of cheese. I can't say John knows that the moon is made of cheese, because the moon isn't made of cheese. And the verb know there is different from the verb think. People can think anything they want. John thinks the moon is made of cheese. Well, then maybe he's crazy. But the reason it sounds weird to say John knows the moon is made of cheese is that it implies that you and I agree that it really is made of cheese, which it isn't. Mm-hmm. And learn is like that. There are other verbs like remember. Mark Twain famously said, I used to remember everything, whether it happened or not. Now I've gotten older and I can only remember the things that didn't happen. Now that's funny. And the reason that it's funny is because it plays on the fact that remember is a factive verb, and you can't remember something that didn't take place. You can think you remember it. You can falsely recall it, but remember doesn't work that way. And learn works that way. So in using the verb learn, he was implying that it really happened. Not that they think, not that they have evidence, not that it's a reasonable guess, but that it is the truth. Mm-hmm. And that was what was misleading about those 16 words. At the time, when it came out afterwards, that not only were there no weapons of mass destruction, but the report that Saddam had tried to buy uranium turned out to be fictitious. People were saying that this was grounds for impeachment because it was a lie. Now, was it a lie? You've got to be careful when you're trying to impeach a president. In his defense, could he say, well, I never said that they really did. I just said that British intelligence had good grounds for believing it. But in using the verb learn, you really are implying that it's a fact. And I think that there were grounds for calling it a lie. I don't think it would have a chance in hell of going through the Senate. But I think the case could have been made.
Analyze, please, Governor Sarah Palin's thanks, but no thanks to that bridge to nowhere.
Oh, I won't talk about the actual fact checking behind it. The fact that it was that too was a lie, because of course she did approve of it before she changed her mind and flip flopped and didn't approve of it. The thanks, but no thanks, of course, is sarcastic. It refers to something that someone is offering you that where you have a mock expression of gratitude, but in fact disdain the offer.
Right.
And so she was using that sarcasm both to imply falsely that she opposed it, but also to convey an attitude that that this was outrageous on the face of it and such a bad deal that it deserved the scorn that the sarcastic expression implies.
And if you hear that kind of phrase over and over and over, then it becomes truth?
It depends on whether there's also some constituency within us, skepticism and commitment to fact-checking to root out the untruths. So I think mere repetition can help, but it depends on the whole kind of ecosystem of fact-checking and insistence on truth.
Mm-hmm. You have a fascinating section on names, and we're living in an era where some of the names people select, I just think, oh my gosh, where did you come up with that name?
How about Track and Trig?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're pretty unusual names, right? Maybe she'll be asked about that by Charlie Gibson tonight. I wouldn't be surprised. But there are cycles of names, right? There are some names you never hear anymore. There are some names that were done for historical kinds of reasons. Why do we have waves of names?
Yes, I know. I'm a victim of that. I'm a Steve, which was a very popular name in the 1950s. And I've gone through life, I've been surrounded by Steves. But now it's kind of dropped off the edge of the table, and boys aren't named Steve anymore. It's an interesting phenomenon because it does change in time. You can date someone, guess their age by their name, if more so for women than for men. So for example, an Ethel is going to be or a Mildred is a senior citizen.
That was my mom's name. Yeah,
okay.
Ethel.
A Deborah or a Susan or a Linda or a Barbara is a baby boomer.
Right.
Then you know, a Jennifer or an Amy is probably a 30-something. And then a Chloe or an Olivia or a Madison is probably a girl.
Huh.
So what's going on? Well, most people think that social trends are effects of some prior cause in the society, that maybe in times of religious revival. People go to biblical names. Maybe people name their kids after some soap opera star or a famous actor or a famous politician. But in fact, even though there are these changes over time, they're largely unpredictable. They come from people reacting to the names that are already out there, not wanting to name give their kid a granny name or an old man name. They want something that's a bit distinctive. They don't want, as Sam Golden was alleged to say, don't name your son William. Every Tom, Dick, and Harry is named William. but not so. Most people, unless you're very, very confident, unless you're like a rock star or an actor, you generally don't want to give your name your kid a name that's totally off the wall, as Frank Zappa famously did with Moon Unit and Dweezil. Most of us are not like that. So when you have a lot of people trying to pick a name that's distinctive but not too distinctive, they're liable to be distinctive in the same way. And so everyone thinks, oh, Chloe, that's an interesting name. I haven't heard too many Chloes lately. And then are shocked when they bring their kid to the daycare center and there are four other Chloes because everyone has been going through the same thought process. But it's not a... the choices are not some symbolic expression of the spirit of the times. The big bubble in biblical names, for example, in all of the Adams and Rachels and Sarahs and so on, was done at a time when religious observance actually had gone down. So there's really no connection. People aren't acting out some kind of cultural script when they're naming kids. It's a matter of fashion.
And what about some of these names that are so hard to pronounce? You wonder how somebody can get through school without every single teacher saying, mispronouncing your name.
Yes, that is something that parents unwittingly saddle children with in their attempt to be distinctive. Yeah. In the case of the trig and the track, what's going on there is that often people will favor particular sounds in names, and one popular name will often bring with it a bunch of names with similar sounds. So when Jennifer became popular in the 1970s, it brought with it Jenna and Jessica and Jesse. And I think what's happening with the trig and the track is that there is an uptick in male names with maybe starting with Travis, which at one point was kind of a hick name, but it became popular, and I think it brought with it Tra and Dra names. Drew is another one, which was obsolete, but then revived, and as these names were revived, the sounds became appealing, and people who wanted to be distinctive didn't want to name yet another boy Travis thought, well, what about some other name that sounds a bit like it, but it's a bit different?
How often do we name people? Evidently, she named Track because they like the track. They like tracks, so why not name your child after a place you like?
Right. But I suspect that sound also influenced the decision. And people, by the way, can't name... I mean, this is a conclusion that psychologists will say is true of all of our decisions. We generally don't know why we do things. If you ask people, why did you do this, that, or the other thing, they will come up with a theory of their own behavior, but it doesn't necessarily correspond to the variables that really did affect their choice.
We have a ton of people who would like to speak with you, and we'll take calls in a moment. Steven Pinker is our guest. His latest book, in paperback now, The Stuff of Thought, Language is a Window into Human Nature. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you want to send an email, then you could do that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls, starting with Stephen, another Stephen from Middleton. Hi, Stephen.
Yes, hi. If the Dunn censorship allows, I'd like to go back with Professor Pinker to the Orwellian Pentagon use of language to manipulate the group mind. Terms like global war on terror, extraordinary rendition, collateral damage. And speaking of the 9/11 phrase, I think there was a reason that day was chosen, exactly in connection with 9/11. That was one big psychological operation. And before you dismiss so flippantly, blame it on a guy in a cave, Al-Qaeda, look at all the evidence for explosives that pulverized those buildings in 7 seconds. That was an inside job.
All right, Stephen,
Yeah, no,
go ahead, Stephen.
I'm not going to buy that.
Yeah.
I think two planes crashed into the towers. Sorry, don't buy the conspiracy theory.
Right. So the Dunn censorship was at work. So sorry. let's go to Daryl from Delavan. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have a question. What space do rhymes fit into in our American use of words, especially
yes.
in regard to political elections and wars, domestic or foreign?
Rhymes, did you say?
Rhymes.
Rhymes.
In terms of wars. I mean, well, rhymes are an example of a class of devices that we use where we take the chunks that the brain uses to store words, and when you repeat one of those chunks, for whatever reason, it's pleasing and it's memorable. So not just in poetry, but if you even look at my little friends, the irregular verbs, they fall into families of rhymes, ring, rang, sing, sang, cling, clung, fling, flung, bind, bound, wind, wound, find, found. And even though you never actually say them in a sequence the way I just did, as a silly little poem, but for some reason, things that rhyme stick in memory better. Alliteration is the other side of the coin, a rhyme, basically the brains of English speakers store words by breaking them down into their onset, that is the consonants at the beginning, the tr or the str, and the rhyme, meaning the vowel and any consonants that come afterwards. If you repeat the rhyme part, what English teachers spell R-I-M-E, then you get rhyme R-H-Y-M-E. If you repeat, on the other hand, the onset, then you get alliteration. And if you repeat an entire phrase structure, you get the device called structural parallelism, like the 23rd Psalm. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters, where it's the syntactic structure that gets repeated, and that's pleasing. And great orators, Martin Luther King, Winston Churchill, will make use of the repetition of a grammatical pattern to make it stick in people's minds. Now, that's something that you can also use in persuasion and rhetoric, and it's a kind of a cheap trick, but it's one that works. You know, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. And experiments have shown that people are, believe it or not, more persuaded by an argument if it is stated in a rhyme than if it isn't.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of stupidity wired into our brains, but a clever manipulator can take advantage of it.
Shortest rhymes the most effective?
I think that's probably true, yes.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Paul from New Berlin. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, language fascinates me with the formation and the relationships amongst cultures and how similar sounds will have either, like ma, will be like mother in many traditions, it seems, or words like nada, like in Sanskrit, it'd be something, nothingness, and then or sound vibration and nothingness in Spanish, which are very close in as far as their metaphysical nature or whatever. Or how the language is formed through translations, too. Like the word Jesus, we're talking about 9/11 being a 9/11 being an abbreviation of a big event. If you think of the concept, theological concept of God being with us, and thinking in the seventh letter of the alphabet, or G, being for goodness or grace or God or whatever, and the G is us, you know, so it's like an abbreviation. It could be, how did they come up with these names? Because his name was Isa in the Aramaic, and Yeshua or Yeshua. It finally came to the point where we call Jesus is the way, or Jesus is the only way, which makes sense if you think that only if God is us, you know, then that's the only way to God is to be, for God to be us. So G is us.
I see. I suspect that the English pronunciation of Jesus may not have reflected that logic directly, but may be the conform to the general translation scheme from Aramaic and other languages to English, where there's usually a pretty predictable algorithm for switching from the sounds of one language to how they're rendered in another. But you are right that there are two phenomena that do shape words over time and sometimes in similar ways across languages. One of them is what's sometimes called sound symbolism. That is that even though in general the name for a thing is arbitrary, you can't predict what something is going to be called just by knowing what it is, people do tend to associate certain kinds of sounds, at least statistically, with certain kinds of meanings. So soft things tend to have soft sounds. Sudden staccato events often will be referred to as sudden staccato sounds, onomatopoeia being an example of it. Say a word like clatter would be onomatopoeic. And if I were to ask you, if you didn't know the meaning of the word mellifluous or the meaning of the word cantankerous, and then I gave you the definitions and I said, which word do you think goes with which concept?
Sure.
The cantankerous kind of sounds cantankerous mm-hmm. just because of those harsh sounds, and you'd pair them up pretty well. And likewise, sounds often will cluster together in to refer to similar things. All the words many of the words in English that begin with gl have to do with the emission of light: glare, glitter, glow, glisten. Words that begin with CL, cl, often refer to things that stick together: clasp, clamp, cluster. And there are lots of families of words where the sounds seem to bleed over in, from one word to another. But the other phenomenon that you were engaging in that discussion is what's sometimes called word magic, where, again, even though linguists will note that the relationship between a sound and a meaning is arbitrary, people will often read significance into why a sound, why something has it the name that it does, as if there was some preordained harmony between the thing and its name. And in many religious traditions, that is, often develops into a complex form of analysis, such as the Kabbalistic gematria, where each letter is given a number and you do a bunch of arithmetic on the numbers, and you try to get divine insight into the nature of the thing from what it's called. An example of gematria that many listeners might be familiar with is the Hebrew word chai for life is corresponds to the number 18, and often in when Jews will give gifts, say for a bar mitzvah or a birth, they'll give them in multiples of 18. It used to be $18 for a bar mitzvah gift, then with inflation it would be, you know, 36 or 72. But the idea is that you're fostering life by giving it a gift in the amount that corresponds to the word life, and that's another example of word magic.
Yeah. How often do you encounter words you don't know, Stephen?
It depends on who I read. But often enough, and I
really?
Have an online dictionary, and I look them up, and I try to remember them.
Huh. I would imagine you do.
I mean, it depends on an author like Nabokov or even Melville. I read Moby Dick a couple of years ago for the first time, and I was constantly running to the dictionary.
Hmm. Paul, is it? Paul? No, it's Mike from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
Had enough time to sit on the phone and chill out a little bit because I was going to have a knee-jerk reaction. But I'd like to just mention that in my own elementary understanding of languages is that I think English is one of those unique languages in the sense that it is the aggregation of words that reflect what I would propose are the three major elements of language, which is you are either trying to inform or you're trying to connote an emotion or you're trying to persuade. And I think all communications have all three of those elements in them at some point, but depending on the context of the communication, you're going one direction or another more directly. Sometimes you want to be more emotional, sometimes you want to be more informative, and sometimes you want to be more persuasive. And in political speech, and this is what I was originally calling about, is when we talk about political speech, is I think oftentimes politicians are really trying to be emotional and persuasive, and depending on the context, some more than the other. But I think most adults understand, I would say the majority of adults understand that political speech is primarily persuasive. So they look for certain groupings of words and certain words that are only used in those particular contexts. And I think we understand that. So that's the knee-jerk that I was going to have is I think that, especially with the news media and all the hubbub we've had, I'll use Sarah Palin as the example right now because it's the most immediate, but you know, same could be said for Obama or Hillary or anybody over the past year, is that, you know, when we pick apart particular sayings, and let me use the bridge to nowhere, is, you know, factually, because of the words that were used and the phrasing that was used, that it was so imprecise, I think we understand that factually it probably is correct how she was saying it. But I think, you know, if we get to informative speech, yes, she would have put a timeline down, and she would have parsed words much more specifically, but what she was trying to do was persuade and provide an emotion. And I think most adults understand that when they hear speeches like that, is that, okay, fine, we'll go to the Fourth Estate and we'll get some informative. The problem is the Fourth Estate right now doesn't do very much of the informative type of language or communication. They're spending way too much time, I think, in their own mode of being persuasive or emotional, and they're not really providing the service that we need. We expect certain things from certain groups of people in their particular context, and I think the biggest failing that we've had in this political season is that the people we expect to be informative are being emotional and persuasive, and the people that we expect to be emotional and persuasive, well, they're being that, and why should we expect anything different?
Stephen.
I certainly agree with most of that, and language indeed has those at least those three functions, not just the English language, but every language. And in an ideal political situation, political discourse, language would be used to inform, for the candidates to inform the electorate as accurately as possible as to what their positions are and what their character is. And there's persuasion that respects the truth. I mean, ideally, in say scientific discourse, you do try to persuade your opponents, but you do so because you try to get them to see that one position is true and the other one is false. So persuasion is not incompatible with a commitment to the truth, but there can also be deceptive persuasion, often using that third component, emotion, as a source of extra oomph. And we're certainly seeing that in political rhetoric. It probably has always been true for as long as there have been democracies. And you're also correct that the role of the press ought to be to bring the debate back to factual matters, to be the watchdog on the claims of truthfulness of the candidates. And I tend to agree that they have not kept up that responsibility, but rather engage in their own entertainment cycle of trying to predict how things will be perceived as opposed to how they ought to be perceived.
Do you think that it's incumbent on the press? The word uppity has come up in reference to Obama several times by members of the Georgia legislature. And there's been a lot of discussion about whether that's a code word for, you know, a black who's above his station in life. And it is amazing to me that you can live in Georgia and not know the history of that particular word. We're into an interesting election here in which there are a lot of code words for race that have found, not all the time, but have found their way to the surface of conversation. What do you think about that?
Yes, the connotations of words, that is, what how they were originally used to evoke emotions can differ from one group of people to another, depending on the era in which you grew up, whether you've read or heard contemporary accounts to know how words were originally used. And you sometimes can get miscommunications when people don't realize that they use a certain word with that had a connotation they didn't realize. Ironically, when Joe Biden referred to Obama as articulate,
right,
earlier this year, that's when they were on opposite sides, either he didn't realize or he secretly used that as a kind of patronizing term for an African American who was perhaps slick with language without the underlying content.
describing a woman as a woman's reaction is hysterical is something that, on the face of it, mm-hmm. could be reasonable, but given the way that hysterical has been used to condescend to women in the past, it's also an inflammatory thing to say.
Yeah. We have an email I'd like to read. What's the difference? Sorry, I got to get to this. What's the influence of celebrities on one selection of names? I have a friend who named his child Brooks after Brooks Robinson, third baseman for the Baltimore Orioles.
Right.
Number two, are there some cultures who take the role of naming their children more seriously? It appears that African Americans select more distinctive names for their children. And number three, upon adopting twin sons as infants, we, in gratitude, named them after two archangels and the patron saints of children, St. Nicholas, and mothers, St. Gerard, Gabriel Gerard, and Nicholas Michael. How much does faith influence the selection of names? Many thanks, Jeff from Dubuque, Iowa.
Yes. Let's see. Certainly the African-American creativity in names, the Shaquille and Latrell and so on, stronger than it is in European Americans, although the trig and track show that white Americans do it as well. And cultures do vary in terms of how much leeway they give parents. And that changes over time as well. One of the trends in baby naming is that there's been an increase in tolerance for creative names in recent decades. Mm. It used to be you had to pick your name from a list. Now people are more creative of both races than they used to be. And it is also true that cultures vary in whether they allow parents leeway at all. There are cultures in which you have to name your child after a saint. In Catholic countries, that's often what people do. Or say in the Jewish tradition, after a deceased ancestor. In among many aristocrats, you want to keep the family lineage, and so you name your son, Henry II, Henry Jr., Henry IV, and so on.
Right.
So there are always a bunch of Henrys. So. Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just laughing. Go ahead.
Yes, okay. So the phenomena of style and fashion as applied to names only occur in a culture where parents do have that leeway, which has been the case in American culture for the last century or so. In fact, many European countries are even more restrictive, not lacking the American concept of or commitment to individual freedom. There are many countries in which you're name for a baby has to be either drawn from a list provided by the government or vetted by the government, and the government can prevent you from giving your child a whimsical or creative name.
Huh, that's interesting. Let's go to Duane next from Florida. Hi, Duane.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Great.
Good.
I have four questions. One is dealing with names that you've been discussing. In the context of 9/11 and world events, Hussein, Barack Obama, and then I'd like to have a comment on the words that were used by our founding fathers and how they've been interpreted today, separation of church and state. Then there's the third one is the word goose for punching or poking someone. And the fourth word I'd like to be commented on would be brown nose.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Comment on those four areas, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, so let's see. The
phone, so I'll hang up and I'll listen.
Okay, that's it. I didn't write them down.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Goose, I'd be willing to bet, comes from the action of geese, namely darting their head to peck at or grab something. So I think the verb to goose must come from what geese do. Brown nosing is an example of a pretty disgusting image. If you think about it, the fact that we use it so freely as to be obsequious toward, and I assume I don't have to explain to listeners where the image
right.
comes from. But it's an example of how words will often lose their tie to the original metaphor or image and just be used as an opaque expression. I doubt that most people who use the word think about the image, and I bet there are people who, especially younger people who may not even know where the word came from.
Mm-hmm.
That often happens with, especially with swear words and taboo words, that the obscene words of one era can sometimes become unexceptionable in the next as the word loses its connection to the original meaning. A perfect example of that in the last 20 years is the word sucks,
mm-hmm.
where my sister told me that when her little girl came home from school one day and said, Jim really sucked today, and she was horrified and was tempted to wash her mouth out with soap. But of course, the little girl, like I suspect many people today, don't realize that the word originated as an obscene term for fellatio.
Right.
But we've lost that image, as I assume many people have with brown nosing.
Right.
The third question was...
Barack Hussein.
Oh, yes, that's right. His middle name was, in fact, Hussein, a very common name in not just in Islamic societies, but in African countries that have Islamic populations. And of course, given the negative connotation to Muslims in the wake of 9/11, cynical politicians will remind people of Obama's middle name in order to somehow hope that they whatever prejudice there is against Muslims will spread to Obama. An example of connotation, how words often have an emotional coloring that has nothing to do with any kind of rational analysis.
We're going to pause for a moment and take more phone calls shortly after a little bitty pause. Our guest is Steven Pinker. His latest book is The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. Our number is 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network. Steven Pinker's book out in paperback now, The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. We have a couple lines open if you've been trying to get through. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Stephen, why is it that there are, and this may just offend my prudish sensibilities, but why is it there are a number of people who swear all the time?
Yes. The frequent use of taboo words in ordinary language, usually in some idiomatic or emphatic way, like this is effing brilliant,
right.
or what the F. What swear words do is they ping the emotional centers of the brain. You get a little jolt every time you hear them, and as a way to either keep up a listener's attention or to assert a kind of macho or cool pose, you can use these words just to keep pinging your listener over and over again. It can also sometimes be used in among intimate circles of friends to signal this is the kind of place where we don't have to watch what we say.
Mm.
We can violate this convention, and collective violating of a formality is one way to bond people.
Interesting. Song, this is an email. Song is a trick that worked for me growing up. Schoolhouse Rock was one of the most important tools I think I used while learning about math, science, politics, history. It goes on and on. Why do we remember the words of songs even decades after we hear them or learn them? We can still remember the words.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah.
Often song lyrics and other formulas are stored both in the left and the right hemisphere.
Hmm.
And sometimes people who lose language because of a stroke in the left hemisphere will be reduced to song lyrics and jingles and prayers and swearing.
Hmm.
The things that are both emotionally colored and that fit into some memorized formula seem to be stored in two ways in the brain instead of just one. Melodies and rhymes have the additional advantage for memory of being redundant. That is, as you get to the end of a second line of a poem, even if you forget what the word is, if you know that it has to rhyme with the last word of the first line,
mm-hmm.
that really narrows down the choices. Likewise, the meter and rhythm of a poem.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you have extra redundant information, that helps memory as well.
John from Madison, hi.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, John.
Hi, can you? Okay, I'm kind of loud, so I don't know if you can hear me.
You're kind of what?
A little loud in the background. Anyway, I just wanted to point out there are three other books that are along these lines. Russian Formalist Criticism.
What was that?
Russian Formalist Criticism.
Uh-huh.
Lenin and Reese. Bison Press.
Uh-huh.
Language and Thought in Action by S.I. Akawa.
Uh-huh.
And Elements of Style, one that a lot of people probably know, by Strunk and White.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder if these books are similar to the one that you're talking about now.
There's a little bit of overlap, and those are different books. I only heard the last two, the S.I. Hayakawa, Language and Thought in Action, by a linguist who later became a California senator and a university president.
Oh, right.
Yes, he was known, famous for ripping the wires out of a sound truck to quash a student protest when he was the president of San Francisco State University. And later, when he was elected senator, he was famous for being caught snoozing a number of times. But before that, he achieved fame in the late 50s and 60s for writing a book called Language and Thought in Action, which was an unlikely runaway bestseller, which pushed a fairly eccentric theory of language called general semantics by a guy named Korzybski, according to which that thought is strongly determined by language. It's a strong version of the linguistic determinism hypothesis, and that you could change people's thinking patterns for the better by language reform. So, for example, if according to one policy suggestion, if we attached a subscript to everyone's name, so we talked about John 1954 and John 1972 and John 1998 and so on, instead of just John, then that would shake us out of the prejudice of thinking that it's the same person who persists over time, whereas in reality we're always changing, and it's not fair to punish someone in 2008 for something they did in 1964 because they were a different person at the time, and it's only because we use the same word for them that we think of them as the same. Now, I think it's a kind of crazy theory. It's way too extreme, and I discuss in the book the relation between language and thought, and it's not nearly that cause and effect relationship that Hayakawa assumed.
Mm.
The Elements of Style by Strunk and White is a little style manual. It's been assigned to students for decades and decades, and I send students to it. I think it's got a tremendous amount of good advice as to how to compose stylish and easy to read prose. And I talk a little bit about style in the Stuff of Thought, but it's not a major theme of the book.
John, thanks for the call. Jimmy from Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, Jimmy, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good.
I want to talk about the way that the meanings of some words bleed into its partner. I'm talking about like old coot, for example, and effete snob.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can call someone a coot, but a coot is just a bird. It can either be a young coot or an old coot.
Well, I think I don't know enough about the habits of coots to know what it is about the coot that reminded someone of a curmudgeonly senior citizen. But whether coots are irritable and short tempered, or what the connection was, but there are of course many derogatory terms for people that come from animals, often from either some emotional reaction that we have to the animal, a snake, a shark, a rat, a pig, or from some characteristic behavior of the animal, as we discussed earlier with meaning the verb to goose. The other one was effete snob. Many people remember Spiro Agnew's denunciation of the press as an effete corps of impudent snobs,
right,
which is kind of ironic because that's a rather effete and snobbish locution.
Yes.
I believe it was actually written by William Safire, who was a speechwriter for Agnew at the time. Yes, and it's been, and Safire, of course, has a marvelous way with words, but it's almost a self-refuting accusation.
And thanks so much for the call. Well, we're out of time. Stephen, thank you so much. We could have gone on and on. It was a great fun hour. I appreciate your time. Stephen Pinker is the author of The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. And he is a professor of psychology at Harvard University and has written several other books as well. That was fun, wasn't it? Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour, and thanks as well to John Treader for on-air production. his other books, he talks about this particular volume rounding out another trilogy, and maybe you've read some of these, three books on human nature, how the mind works, and also The Blank Slate, and now this book, The Stuff of Human Thought. So, a couple things to remind you of. I'm no longer here on Fridays, so I'll be with you again on Monday. Veronica Rickert will be here tomorrow from 9 to 11. Monday, Bob Schieffer will be with us, longtime Washington Bureau chief and anchor and interviewer for CBS News. He's written a book about his many years in the news business, and so he will be with us on Monday. We'll have our All Things Political on Monday, which we always do. And just a reminder, as we get closer to the time to vote for the presidency and other offices, we'll be taking our show on the road Thursday, October 30th, 9 to 11 a.m. at the Alumni Memorial Union Ballroom at Marquette University. A reception will follow. We'll have, well, we'd like to have presidential candidates, but we certainly will have political analysts and people from the major campaigns. And we'd like for you, in addition to Marquette students and faculty, to join us in the audience. You can do that by calling 414-227-2047 to sign up. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.